This is the end of history.
A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies.
We believe that peace is at hand.
An axis of evil arming to threaten the peace of the world.
Democracy and freedom for all.
We must choose in this crucial moment of human history.
Okay, End of History listeners, I'm J.B. Shreve, and joining me for this podcast episode, we've got a special movie review. I guess it's a movie review. It's a little more than that, I hope. But I have Jonathan Webster.
Hello.
And Jessica Llewellyn, or J-Lew and J-Web is how I refer to them frequently. I'll probably slip up and do that here. But we're going to look, this is probably something we're going to start doing more frequently, maybe once a month. We might miss a month every once in a while. But we enjoy watching movies. And we have a variety of tastes between us. And what we like most about movies is not just a good entertaining movie, but we like something that makes us think. And so maybe once a month, we're going to try to do a movie, some kind of film, sometimes a documentary, sometimes a feature film that caused us to think. We want to look at those types of movies that when you watched it, you kept thinking about it for a few days afterwards and you got perspective on it. And so that's what we're doing tonight. We're recording this at night on this podcast episode. The specific movie we're looking at today is one called A Hidden Life. Now, this came out at the end of 2019. And I remember when it came out, I alerted both of you and also Mike, my friend Mike. I wanted to go to the theater, wanted to be sure and see this together when it came out. And I don't believe it ever arrived at our local theaters. We have a few up here, and I don't remember seeing it here. Did I miss it?
I don't think it ever came here.
Yeah, so this isn't like it's not like a big commercial sensation type of film. It's an excellent film. It's an incredible film. I've seen it twice so far. But even when it came out on video, it came out as the pandemic was heating up, and I saved it on my Amazon list for months, and I told my wife, I said, I want to watch that, but I want to watch it with Jonathan and Jessica and Mike. That was the specific thing. And it sat there for a year. And I thought, this is going to be one where it just disappears and I'm not going to get to watch it. And so finally, Mike and I watched it together and I loved it. I don't want to criticize it. It's not an entertaining movie. I had some friends in South Dakota where
I was going to bring this story up actually.
Yeah, this is a movie that I really like. It makes you think.
Comparison.
But it's not a movie. This isn't Avengers. It's right. Not Infinity Wars. It's very artistic, but it's not, I guess it is artsy, but that's not what I'm walking away from this film with. I had some friends in South Dakota and I recommended a movie to them once. We were just talking and I told them how much I love the movie There Will Be Blood. Mm-hmm. What's the guy's name? Daniel Day-Lewis.
Daniel Day-Lewis, yeah.
And who's the guy who made
Paul
the movie?
Paul Thomas Anderson.
Yeah. So yeah. I love that movie, but I like dark movies and it's a darker sort of movie. And we didn't talk a lot about it, but I found out they took the movie to deer camp. very much the wrong environment. They're watching it like, I don't know, maybe you watch Die Hard or John Wick or something like that at deer camp. You don't watch There Will Be Blood. And they watched it, and when it was over, they just looked around and someone said, I'm going to kill Jeff Shreve. They had wasted their time on it. It's not wrong environment. This is not a commercial type of movie. This is one. No. My wife, actually, I've seen it twice now. I watched it once with Mike, and then I watched it here this weekend with Jonathan and Jessica because we wanted to do a podcast specifically on it. But my wife, she said it's 3 hours long, so there's that. And that's
Which I did not know.
Yeah, well, neither. The first time we watched it, like I've taken a break during the middle of it on each time I've watched it now.
Yeah.
Casey refers to it. My wife refers to it as that 3 hour movie. Oh, she does like it. She said she liked it better the second time, but she said the first time I watched it, according to her, she said, I'm just going to finish this because I'll never have to watch it again if I can just get through it. So that's all the bad news. It's not really as bad as we've just made it sound sound.
But it's definitely not something you want to put on when you're sleepy. It's like, if you're sleepy, you might fall asleep because the better part of it is pretty peaceful and just beautiful scenery and quiet.
Yeah.
But yeah. So
there's more internal dialogue in this movie than there is actually person-to-person dialogue.
So like much you're body hearing language. His
thoughts. Yeah. Yeah. Lots of beautiful scenery. I wish I could have seen this in a theater just because of the scenery that was so well filmed and all of that.
Yeah.
That good stuff. I remember the first time I watched it, I remember it was almost, it was stressful. And I just recognized the difference as I was thinking about this today. The first time I watched it, I felt like I was experiencing what this guy went through. And it was kind of stressful. Like I just wanted to end type of thing. And it's not because of the length of the film. It just, it was a hard movie to watch. The second time I watched it, I was far more aware of the spiritual things in it. Like there's a lot of talk about faith, a lot of talk about Christianity and things like that, which I don't remember at all the first time I saw it. So yeah, it's like it didn't stick out to me the first time.
It stood out very strongly to me. Before we get too far in, do you want to like summarize what this movie's about?
Yeah, J-Lew, you summarize it for us, and then Jonathan, we can jump in and add anything we want to the summary.
Yeah. So it all takes place in the Austrian Alps in this little village. It's a farmer who lives up in the mountains, and it starts in the late 30s, but it's as the Nazis have taken over in Austria, and it focuses on a farmer and his family. The farmer's name is Franz, and it's based on a real person.
Yeah.
So on probably the first half of the movie, you're seeing just their life. You see how the farmer and his wife meet each other. And you see that they have some children. You see their day-to-day life on this farm. You know, it's the late 30s and early 40s. And honestly, all the tools they use and the buildings look like they could have been from 50 years earlier. It seems kind of primitive, probably to our eyes especially, but it's really beautiful.
Beautiful but, scenery. You know, and it's so beautiful. A beautiful score, musical score behind it. It's like,
absolutely.
I felt like I was watching a symphony while I'm watching it, you know, because everything, it's kind of like your senses are really filled up without there being a lot of strobe lights or anything like that.
Yeah.
There's an editor I really like. He did a series of YouTube videos named Tony Zhu. He goes by the YouTube name Every Frame of Painting. And he said one of the best compliments you can pay a movie is that it feels alive. And I thought of that a lot while we watched A Hidden Life. And I was thinking, man, this movie just feels alive. But continue, Jayla, because keep going.
Yeah, I want to come back to that later. But you know, when the Nazis took over Austria, they basically forced all Austrian men to train in their army. And so you see the farmer goes to his training and he's already starting to wrestle with the idea of the Nazis. Like the people in the village are hearing about things that are happening. And so he has these whispered conversations with different people in the town, with the mayor and priests. His priest and different other people whispered conversations with his wife and
he's processing it. He's trying to figure out what he knows. He doesn't feel right about it, but you see him go through this journey of deciding. And it's real funny when he finally makes that decision of where he stands on it. It's when those two guys pass him and they say Heil Hitler, and he says something else back to him that I won't say on the podcast, but it's in Austrian or whatever he's speaking.
So he completes the training and comes back to his wife, but he hasn't been officially, I think conscripted is the right term. There's several scenes where they're walking down these paths between their farm and the town, and there's bicycle messengers, and there is a clear sense of dread every time the bicycle messenger comes by, because they're anticipating that he would be conscripted at some point. And about halfway through the movie, he does get a letter that he's supposed to report for duty. And he has already, settled in his mind and his heart that he can't commit an oath to Hitler and Hitler's ideals.
Right.
And so he's basically in turmoil to know what to do.
And I think it's important to note there, because He's technically a conscientious objector, but he's not objecting to war or to fighting. You know, it was specifically to the oath to Adolf Hitler. And I thought that was real important to note, because it seemed like such a small thing. And over and over again, he's challenged with, nobody, this is not going to change anything.
Oh, man.
What you're doing here, nobody's going to notice. Nobody. One guy even challenges him and says, have you thought about who has to take your place? Because you're not going, so you're actually doing more harm than good here. And it's like there's all of these arguments, but ultimately he can't do that. There's something inside of him that can't make that that oath.
The number of people who, the number of tactics used by various peoples, ranging from people in his village to the lawyers to the army, and others I won't mention for spoiler free, but the number of tactics used to try and break in on him and make him change his mind really stood out to me.
Yeah,
the number of times and the number of ways he was basically told, "Your decision does not matter. Stop doing this to yourself."
Yeah,
really intriguing.
Yeah, there's a consistent like minimizing of it, minimizing of his conviction and minimizing of his action. Like you said, from every front. And
when you're sitting in his shoes, looking at life from his perspective, it makes sense to minimize it. It's like, this is causing my family so much grief. This is causing my village so much grief. And it's like, I thought it was so well done. It was just so well done how that was presented.
Yeah, I also appreciated, once he's conscripted, he does go along, but at a certain point, he's no longer treated as a soldier, and you really see the effect on his wife and his family that he's left. The townspeople really treat them very poorly. You see in the first half of the movie how kind of collaborative or like community oriented the farming is, where they all work together in a lot of ways. And suddenly when the town realizes that he's not going to go along with it, nobody will help his family anymore. No one will work with them. And
cold shoulder is really strong.
Yes. Right. Yeah. And, in a world where life was already hard work from dusk till dawn, and then suddenly the husband is gone and the community is not there, you really see the toll it takes on the wife and the rest of the family.
Right.
That was really striking.
There was a really good scene that I really liked that stood out on that point, where it was all in, I think, German. You don't even understand what they're saying. There's no subtitles. But like they go to farm, and I'm not even sure exactly what's happening, but the village like turns on them, and there's a big argument like in German where the villagers are clearly, because this movie has a lot of body language, right? And a lot, you just kind of are seeing the heart, not necessarily a lot of dialogue. And the village just kind of turns on him and his wife, and they kind of spit them out of the community, and refuse to let them use those fields or those public spaces. I'm not even really sure what was happening. And I thought it was really beautiful how powerful it was, even though I had no idea what they were saying or even exactly what they were fighting about, but it was, their intent was very clear.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought this movie, I feel like our discussion there, I could take two different routes. I could talk all about kind of the cinematography and the art component of like, man, what a well done film that like, so much body language and reading of the heart rather than through words. But honestly, Jeff, you said that the spiritual component of this movie stood out to me very strongly. So I could go either direction you guys want to go at any time, but I feel like those are two really big points.
We can hit both of those. Jayla, are you done with your summary? I know we're trying to stay away from spoilers. We were talking about this before we started recording, whether we would give away the ending. It's about the Nazis. It's about World War II. If you don't know how that's going to end, you're going to be surprised, I guess, but we're not going to spell it out specifically, but there's not a whole lot of surprise there, but my, that's not really what the movie's about.
My wife asked me ahead of time, is this going to be a feel good movie? And I was like, I really don't know, but it is set during World War II. So,
No, I did want to speak to the aspect that Jonathan has mentioned about the body language and the movement. I read a little bit about it, and apparently that was a big part of the direction from the director to the actors. So the director is Terrence Malick, and he's known for these really sweeping, kind of dramatic stories with really beautiful visuals. But apparently, like, he kind of just told the actors never stop moving. And so I think it kind of, it gives you that sense of kind of urgency, and you feel like you're seeing them wrestle with things internally as they're moving, which Jeff, I think you mentioned the first time you felt like a sense of stress. And I kind of felt that too. It was like almost, and I wouldn't have put my finger on it until I read that quote, that there's something about the way they're constantly moving. It feel, I mean, like, I thought about in the Bible where Jacob wrestles with God. It's like there's this sense of like they are wrestling with themselves, right, and with God constantly through this movie. And that really, to me, feels like the core of the story, is that process of the of wrestling, but coming to clear resolution and then having to wrestle out of it, in a sense, walk it out.
Yeah, every scene with the main character and his children, that stuck out to me. I don't know. My mind kind of gravitates when I saw the movie A Quiet Place. Like, that was not a horror movie to me. That movie was about fatherhood, because if you watch every scene with the dad in that movie, he's every single scene with the dad, he's doing something to make life better in this dangerous world for his wife or his kids, every single one of them. And that stuck out to me. And this one, every single scene of him with the children, he's acting like a clown. Like, he's acting like you don't see grown men act.
Yeah.
And yet I think most grown men, when they're alone with their kids, act this way. He's spinning circles. He's playing games. It's like there's something about a dad, especially with little kids, where I told someone the other day, I feel like I've been Bozo the Clown for the life of the for the course of the pandemic, just making sure my little guy's entertained and engaged. And it's like, that's something about being a dad. Like, you play with the kids, and he's always playing with the kids in this. And it stuck out to me because it made him very, very human. He's not this firebrand orator. He's not a patriot. He's not a writer. He's just a farmer. He's a good dad. And he has a conviction that he's carrying.
You know, you use the word right there, conviction. I knew that we were going to get to that. When we took a break while watching it, you, Jeff, said, I think that's what this movie's about. It's about conviction. And I was like, oh, great. I'm tracking, because that's what I was going to say too. So, like, so which way to take it? Definitely about conviction, and watching that guy interact with his kids with the specter of like looming war, I think was very touching. Mm-hmm. From a artsy perspective, I thought it was kind of interesting wondering what Terrence Malick, the writer and director, was thinking about. There was like some whispers of like modern politics, at least in the United States. Like, I was wondering if he was thinking about Trump when he wrote this movie, when directed.
I read that he started writing the movie about 6 years before it was filmed. So that would have been before Trump was even running for president. I thought that was interesting, because it does, through a certain lens, you could very much interpret it through that context. But
and that honestly really makes me rich. Like it more, to, because it's dealing more with a principle of how do you respond to chaotic times? How do you respond to at the beginning of the film, it shows how high in the Alps they live. And there's even the wife's voice is saying, we thought we could, I think it's the wife's voice, we could stay safe and away from it all in our home in the clouds. And then you see the wife looking up, and it never shows it, but you hear a plane flying overhead. Mm-hmm. And she's just looking up, the wife and the kids are looking up, and they see a plane. And it's like, you can't escape what the world's going through right now. There's chaos all around, and there's going to be a reckoning for decisions where you land on these issues. And I'm really glad that that was not a political statement. It's a statement of principle.
Yeah. Yeah, it would be really interesting to hear his perspective, but Terrence Malick is notoriously private. Like, I don't think he's ever given really any interviews. He doesn't talk to the public at all, really. So but I think you're totally right. I mean, they are in one of the most remote places in Europe. And they're not untouched. We don't see, as we're watching the movie, we don't see any battle scenes. We don't see any anything like that, but they are still not untouched. Even the wife who never leaves the farm,
right,
not because, untouched by it,
because the battles were internal. You know, it's called a hidden mm-hmm. life, and there's several layers to the meaning of that. There's this life that we've never heard of, and yet he's the, well, the movie ends with this quote from George Eliot, and I've got it pulled up here. It says, "For the growing good of the world is partly dependent on unhistoric acts, and that things are not so ill with you and me as they might have been is half owing to the number who lived faithfully a hidden life and rest in unvisited tombs." It's the heroes, basically, is what that's saying. The heroes are the hidden life, so we never hear anything about. That's one layer of it. But to me, yeah, after watching it the second time, the hidden life is really more about this thing inside each of us where we're working out our convictions, working out yes. what's right and wrong in the face of times. And I think we live in these kind of times right now. I'm not saying the Nazis are out there, but times where life is becoming more complicated, more complex, more confusing for many out there. And there is a requirement for that hidden life in every one of us to be engaged and make decisions on where we stand. And I love this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Go
ahead.
I was just going to say, there were so many key scenes that mm-hmm. were him like working out what he thought and seeking counsel to some degree. You know, he went to friends in the town, in the village. He went to his priest, who then sent him to his bishop, I think. And I know we touched on this earlier, but you know, all of those conversations, none of them brought him relief from that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I just think there were so many powerful things that came up in those discussions.
Yeah,
I know. Yeah. We no talked one about
make the decision for him. He had to make the decision himself. You know, no one necessarily. Yeah. Well, a lot of people said it's the wrong decision, but like the priest and
the painter.
Yeah. That was the big scene of the movie for me. That's the takeaway. And we're going to go into that here in a minute, but these discussions, they never are saying, this is what you need to do, but they're saying, I can't make the decision for you. Do you realize what this is going to do to your family? You know, mm-hmm. but not necessarily don't do this, but have you really counted the cost here?
Yeah.
That scene with the painter was very touching. I think there's a, so just to set the scene up there, he goes to the church that he attends, and there's a painter painting scenes on the roof and walls of the church. And he makes a comment about parishioners at this church and says, you know, they look up at these paintings and they imagined if they'd lived during Christ's time, they wouldn't, you know, do X, Y, Z.
Yeah.
And then kind of a short little bit later, he says, someday I'll paint a true Christ.
Hopefully this captures on a podcast, on an audio podcast, but imagine this huge cavernous, I guess it's a cathedral, but J.Lew, you're the architect. I don't know if it's a cathedral or not, but it's got the murals all over the ceiling, very ornamented. And this painter is drawing all of the pictures. And as he's drawing these things, he's talking to the guy, but it's really more of an internal dialogue that's going on.
Paint the tombs of the prophets. I help people look up from those pews and dream. They look up and they imagine that if they lived back in Christ's time, they wouldn't have done what the others did. They would have murdered those whom they now adore. I paint all this suffering that I don't suffer myself. I make a living of it. What we do is just create sympathy. We create admirers. Don't create followers. Christ's life is a demand. We don't want to be reminded of it. So we don't have to see what happens to the truth. Darker time is coming. And men will be more clever. They won't fight the truth. They'll just ignore it. I paint their comfortable Christ with a halo over his head. How can I show what I haven't lived? Someday I might have the courage to venture, not yet. Someday I'll paint a true Christ.
Yeah, that scene really was, Jeff, you said it was one of the stronger scenes in the movie. I felt like there was two big spiritual takeaways for me in this movie. And the first one was, what would I do? Which is really, he's asked the painters kind of making you think that. I feel like that's kind of something that we talked about even in one of our last movie and television reviews last year, where we talked about that show Messiah. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that it, to a lesser degree, it was much more pronounced in this movie, but one of the things that Messiah made you think was like, if I was there, would I see this?
Right.
Like, what it kind of makes you challenge yourself, like if you were there. And I think since World War II, since the 40s, people have probably been talking about, every generation's probably talked about, if I was there, would I? And more than World War II, it is the moment of like resistance, where you get resistance and there's no external confirmation for your conviction. And that is the place that you're called to occupy as a person of faith, and as a person of conviction and principle. And I wrote some notes about just how it reminded me of sometimes reading the Bible and reading like Matthew and reading the Sermon on the Mount and just reading the words of Jesus and not, and like stripping away the familiarity of them and thinking like, you actually said this. I really want to take you seriously. Am I taking you seriously enough? Like, you almost feel a little bit of a holy fear when you when you kind of strip it away and you think, am I doing this? And how you can see other people's hearts get hard and in very subtle ways that affect your just what you say and what you think. And I feel like that's really portrayed well in this like town, this small, remote town that is resisting this guy and his beliefs, and he can't find any reference point even when he goes to his bishop and is
right. So next week we are going to begin releasing the episodes in a new podcast series at the end of history, one of our history series, where we look at the history of genocide. And the timing of that and this podcast is just coincidental. You know, we're not really talking about Holocaust or genocide in this episode, but one of the themes we keep revisiting in that story, that those historical episodes, is how everyone always says they wouldn't do it. They would not. Brian, the guy who's joining me for that podcast series, he pointed out a quote, I think it's from Jordan Peterson, that when people think of the Holocaust, they imagine themselves in the role of either the victim or the role of the liberators, the heroes. No one ever imagines themselves in the role, at least no normal people, imagines themselves in the role of the oppressor, the person who's doing the injustice. But the reality is, the podcast series is called Never Again, Again. We keep saying we're never going to let this happen again, but it keeps happening throughout history because people continue to gravitate towards evil. And it's because it's far more easy to become evil, to walk outside of those convictions, to do what's easier in the moment. Like this guy's in the movie, A Hidden Life, like his village did. It was easier to go the path of least resistance and justify it. And your whole environment will justify it. But it's very difficult to live that life of conviction that allows you to live free of the mob where they're going.
Mm-hmm. I thought it just portrayed the hardening of hearts so well. Cause you know, you see the snapshot of his small town and you see his, his eccentric sounding mayor, and you know, they're all out there and, you know, celebrating. But over the course of the movie, the mayor is quite a figure of resistance.
Yeah.
And you just think like I found myself thinking like, what would I have said to you to try to break you out of that? Like thinking if I was talking to that mayor, like what would I have said to like, been like, dude, what are you doing? Who are you? And you can't get through. Yeah. You can't get through once people let their hearts get hard. And I feel like it's.
Yeah.
But did the mayor seem evil to you?
No, that was the frustrating part. He seemed like a dude who got swept up. His heart got hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I thought, especially with the mayor, I made connections in my mind to certain people in the Bible, like Nebuchadnezzar and Saul, who once they gave their heart over to something incorrect, like God let them take it, and they became almost like wild animals, right? They became they lost their minds to some degree, and that was the kind of vibe I got from the mayor. Is like he bit the poison, and it's tainted him, you know, and he's just a little bit off the deep end and started becoming really aggressive towards these people that, you know, this family that was a friend of his and just a short time before. Just really interesting.
And the way they do it in the movie, though, it's I could even feel for the mayor. It's like, he's trying to keep all of his people safe. And he goes and tells the guy, you're the only one who's doing this. You're the only one doing this. There was another statement, the wife, again, it's one of those points of internal dialogues, but the statement she makes is, you can't change the world. The world is stronger. And I thought that was significant, crushing. Because everyone imagines they're going to change the world with their big stand, you know, for righteousness or whatever it is that you're standing for. And the reality is, you're probably not. And maybe that's not really the point. And that's what this guy realized at some point. He never vocalizes that, but people say this to him over and over in some form or another. It's not about changing the world. It's about keeping yourself where you're supposed to be. Like it's guarding that conviction was significantly important to him.
Yeah. I remember there's a conversation with someone who says, when he's saying, I can't do what I know is wrong, he says, do you have a right to do this? And his response is, do I have a right not to?
Right.
Like, what? How can I not follow this conviction that's in my heart?
I was taking notes on this movie the second time around, like I was doing a Bible study. I mean, there was just so many good points in there. He, when he's talking to the bishop, he says, if God gives us free will, we are responsible for what we do or what we fail to do. Aren't we? He's wanting the bishop to confirm that to him. And I think it was right there where he makes that statement where he says, can I not avoid this? I mean, how can I give into this?
You know, it's kind of funny how I'm just now realizing this, but it's kind of funny how there's this movie have a lot of statements followed by questions of doubt. So one thing that sticks out to me that I wanted to talk about was what an amazing figure his wife was in this movie, because she was it's very realistic. I mean, it's based on a true story, but her kind of wavering from resolute to worry and to doubt and then to resolute again was really striking. There was a scene where she said to him, you know, kind of like wondering, she says, why have our prayers not been answered? And then she quotes the Bible and she says, if you're faithful to him, he'll be faithful to you. She pauses and then she says, I believe it, that's enough. And you're like, man, good for you. And then 15 minutes later, she's crying and she says, you're going to do this, aren't you? You're going to deny Hitler. And she breaks down in tears and there's doubt. That, and I think that's where she says, you can't change the world. The world is stronger. Yeah. And it really, I think that's so interesting how many times there was like statement followed by question of, do I really believe that? So her saying, you know, I believe it. That's enough. And then now you got to live that out. And tough. It's not easy.
Right.
He made this statement. There was one point in the prison and he's nearing the point of losing his mind. There's even a figure there. I'm not sure if the figure was real, who's talking to him, who's kind of taunting him. It's almost like
right.
Like he's representative of the devil and he's telling him all of these things. And I don't know if the guy was supposed to be real or just in his imagination because of the way the film, the movie is filmed, the way the story is told, but he starts quoting Psalms. And again, it's, you're hearing his internal dialogue, and it's not one Psalms. He's quoting several all throughout. And it's amazing to me the first time I watched it, I didn't pick up on all the scripture that's in this movie, but it, there is a lot in there. There was one statement, not a psalm, but a profound statement. He says, there's a difference between the kind of suffering we can't avoid and the suffering we choose.
Yeah.
And I thought about that. It's like, wow, that's really true. There's things that, you know, if you're born with a disability or just the environment you live in, there's things that you learn to cope with, learn to deal with. But then there's other sufferings that you choose because you have sight of something higher, something greater. And it's like, I'm willing to sacrifice for this. That's not a rational response to choose suffering. That's not a rational response to life. It's a very spiritual response. And I think that's what makes us, makes a human very unique, is to be able to operate at that level. And when he made that statement, it was one of the many points in the movie where I'm just, it leaves me thinking, it leaves me considering and pondering. And that's what I like about this movie.
Yeah. I think the thing I like most about this movie is in that section of the movie where he is, he's imprisoned and he's facing possibly ultimate punishment for his choice. And yes, all of the Psalms that he quotes, I wrote down that it actually felt a little life-giving to me as a viewer. I felt refreshed when he was quoting Psalms.
He was getting focused. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that the two spiritual things that stood out to me, I told you the first one was the kind of what would I do? And the second one that really stood out much more and really had me thinking days after this movie and affected me emotionally, I cried, I teared up, was just the intensity of conviction in the face of death, or when, you know, reconciling mortality and whether or not you belong to a different country. Mm-hmm. And there's so many quotes I wanted to talk about. I think the one that stands out the most is it is his kind of internal dialogue. I don't think they show you who he's talking to, but he says, when you give up the idea of surviving at any price, a new light floods in. And I felt it's amazing what art can do, what a well done movie can do. Cause I just felt kind of carried away in the feeling of like, yeah, the choice that you make to stand in your conviction, even in the face of death, the Hebrews 11 kind of experience. And man, it really touched my heart. And more than just considering like, what would I do? I just felt that inner conviction as a viewer. I felt kind of like touching that inner conviction, being like, yeah, that core is there.
Yeah.
I understand you. You're my brother. I know who you're, I know what you're talking about, and I would be there with you. Not lightly said, but it was very powerful that way that was communicated. And his capture, even in the face of struggle and his own turmoil, but his capture of that he was going to honor his convictions and he was going to please God, because he talked about God quite a bit, but it was very relatable. And as another movie comparison, I don't know how well this will be received, but in the movie The Return of the King, Lord of the Rings, there's a scene where Gandalf and I think Pippin are like about, they think they're going to die. And so Pippin basically is like, I wish this had never happened. And kind of, he's like, what's the next place like? And Gandalf kind of tells him a little bit and talks about, you know, white shores and a far green country. And Pippin's like, yeah, that sounds really good. And that scene's always been touching to me, but I felt like that, you know, it's fantasy, right? But this movie had that feeling magnified, which was like, I am a foreigner here. I don't want to suffer. I'm not a glutton for punishment, but I am a foreigner here. And I feel it so strongly. I felt this movie really communicated that, and I really resonated with it.
Yeah. There was a scene when he's in the, and we're near the end here, because I could just keep rehashing quotes, rehashing scenes, but there was one where he's in the, just in the depths of despair in the prison, and he's reflecting back on joyous times with his wife and his kids, and just playing with the kids on the land, and just, it was so full of life. There was so much life there, like you could almost smell it, you know, that the scenery and everything. And in that, I had the thought, okay, on the other side of this this dimension, on the other side of mortality, for those who do hold true to the conviction, who do hold true to the faith, that is like amplified times 1,000 or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's why we should desire. The Bible says, don't love this world. Love, we're supposed to long for the kingdom of God, for the return of Christ. And that's why, because we get a glimpse of that thing that was so perfect in his memory. That's actually just a glimpse, maybe an echo of what's on the other side of mortality. Yeah. And it that's why he could have hope in the midst of those very trying times.
And yet still be a human being who's affected by your emotions and your ties to this, but your faith is stronger. And I think that was very beautifully portrayed. He absolutely had that conviction and that sight, and he was a human being. He wasn't an action superhero. He quaked in fear, and it was really beautiful.
Yeah. You know, I feel like the whole story and the title captures it, and that quote that the title comes from, it really gives a sense of weight and dignity and value to those deep, small convictions that each of us as an individual may carry. You know, like, I live in a small town in a forgotten state, and I have a small life in all reality, but my life and my deep inner conviction carries weight, and it has beauty, and it has value in the scheme of things because of where that conviction comes from.
Right.
That's what I love about this movie, is it really captures that idea. Like legitimately, we are getting to see a hidden life, and
exactly.
You know, his convictions take him to a certain place, and yet we all have convictions in our hearts that that have that kind of value, and that have that kind of lasting impact, even if we don't get to see it.
I think that's an excellent point, Jaylee. We all have the capacity for a hidden life. To live at that level. That's not something we have to wait for the crisis to hit. We should be taking hold of that now. I want to close with a recommendation from you guys to listeners who want to watch this movie. My concern is that someone's going to go watch this movie, get 30 minutes in it, and think, I'm going to kill Jeff Shreve. not what they thought it was, because it's a different kind of movie. But any recommendations on how it should be viewed if people choose to go watch this?
I say make sure you're not tired and watch it with people that that you care about, that you share a journey with. Or talk about it with people, because you may pick out particular scenes or quotes that we didn't hear or talk about. But yeah, that's my recommendation. It's worth it. Take a break in the middle if you need to. There's a clear kind of middle point that you can. Pause for a minute. But man, it's so worthwhile.
Yeah. I definitely recommend a break in the middle. It is a long movie, but it is very worthwhile. And I also recommend, just from a good exercise, is to ask why you're seeing the characters doing the thing that they're doing. What is the motive or emotion that's being conveyed there? Because this movie is actually a little light on dialogue. And so you could think, why am I seeing clip number 5 of people just doing stuff? What's the point? And I think it's a very artistic and very well done way of revealing their heart and what their values are. And so when you're watching it, don't just think, oh man, when's the next dialogue that's going to tell me what's going on? Because this is not a movie where dialogue communicates what's actually happening. Because even some of the dialogue that is there, it's done out of sync with what you're seeing. So watch it with the patience to ask yourself, what is being conveyed to me here? Because none of those shots were done flippantly. They do communicate things. And you don't have to be a movie expert. You don't have to be an art critic to appreciate it. But it is not a conventional dialogue, talking to each other type of movie. And it is worth watching. And the journey is worth it.
Yeah.
I think if you think of it as poetry instead of narrative, it sets your mind in a certain way. to realize there's some unpacking to do for sure.
That's a good way to put it. That's a good way to put it. And if you do watch it and you like it, I'd love to hear from you. Go to the Facebook post. We always put whenever these podcast episodes released, I always put a Facebook post up so that people can find the link and things like that. Just go there and let us know what you thought. I'd be curious to know what listeners out there thought. I'd recommend not watching it with too big of a group. We had five people for, something like that. That's about as big as I'd probably get, because it's too big. It turns into a different kind of movie.
But, yeah, you might not want to cry if you're in too big of a group, but I definitely cried.
I didn't cry. I don't know what y'all's problems are.
Oh, come on there, Jeffrey.
John Wick, I cried at. John Wick, I cried at.
It was sad when those dogs died, okay? No, I definitely teared up and cried, and I heard some other sniffles in the room, so I'll just leave it at that.
I think I was just getting a little bit sleepy as well. All right, we're going to wrap it up there, and we'll try to do one of these maybe next month sometime. We'll do another film, but there are more podcasts coming from The End of History. Also, there's going to be some more articles and stuff like that there at the website. So if you haven't yet, go to theendofhistory.net, go to the bottom right hand corner of the screen and click the little bell so that you can be alerted whenever there's new stuff posted. And I think that's going to do it. We will talk to you all next time.
Bye.
Bye.
J.B. Shreve. Check out more episodes at iTunes and wherever you download quality podcasts. Join us online at theendofhistory.net for articles and essays from the end of history. Follow J.B. on Twitter at JB_Shreve. The End of History is produced by Windmill Media.